Hi, I'm John London. Welcome back to Thinking It Through, a twice-monthly podcast, or thereabouts, where I explore the reflections and connections that people make to their personal history and geography. In this last year or so, while living in Santa Fe, I've come across a number of creative artists, performers, painters, and writers now residing in this most beautiful northeastern part of New Mexico. Some of these folks are native to the area, born here. Others are transplants and continue to practice their art. Jada Griffin, a painter of large abstracts and female figuratives, is one of the more interesting and talented individuals I've come across in Santa Fe since relocating here last summer. My wife and I met her at the Marigold Gallery up on Canyon Road a few months ago, and we were impressed with her knowledge and passion for the arts. I'm also happy she agreed to spend some time with me discussing her life's journey as an artist and entrepreneur. As you will hear, prior to moving here in 2013, Jada was the owner and primary artist of the Janice Griffin Gallery in the renowned Pearl District of Portland, Oregon, for 10 years. She has combined art and business for decades, though she's the first to admit she much prefers living daily as an artist. We sat down for a bit of a talk earlier this past December. What follows is about an hour of that conversation. Thanks much for listening. Now here's Jada Griffin. Jada, thanks for talking with me today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you so much, John.
Yeah, it's great.
I'm excited.
It's great to finally get this going. We've had a couple stumbles as I've tried to hold on to my gear, but now I have it, and we're ready to go. Jada, what I'd like to do is maybe have you introduce yourself to our audience. Who you are today, what are you doing today,
sure.
What kind of things do you do professionally?
Well, John, I am a professional painter, and I've been a professional painter probably, I could say, since my mid-30s or so. Of course, painted all my life from my early teen years, and took a little bit of a circuitous route, I would say, to come full circle back to doing what I do love the most and what is instinctive for me, and that is painting. Mm-hmm. You know, I hear so often people telling me that they weren't encouraged to go into the arts for their education, and that's true for me, but instinct, I think, just pulled me back to doing what I love to do. And the arts across the board, I would say, because I also write, and I'm a published writer, published in Portland Interview Magazine last year, but I'm also a dancer and a music lover. So it's really across genres, I would say.
Yeah.
And here in Santa Fe, where I came 6 years ago from Portland, Oregon, I'm the art director at a gallery on Canyon Road, Marigold Arts, mm-hmm. which also represents my painting there. Mm-hmm. So I'm there a few days a week, and then in my studio painting the rest of the week. And I've been in Santa Fe 6 years. I loved Portland, Oregon, but I do feel very rooted and grounded now here in New Mexico.
Well, I remember my wife and I stepped into the gallery, and we were a bit timid about stepping into galleries because we don't generally command, you know, the kind of income to buy things up on Canyon Road. But we loved your gallery in terms of the textiles that are on one end of it. I know
right.
that we enjoyed that. And then you were so exceptionally communicative about your work and the other works that were around there. So we appreciate that.
Well, thank you. And I think also there's an art to speaking and communicating. And that's partly why I'm actually thrilled to have this opportunity to speak into a microphone. But I do want to say that, you know, I owned my own art gallery in the Pearl District in Portland, Oregon for 10 years. And one of the things that I said to myself when I had the gallery then was that anyone who has a job can buy art. And you said something about being intimidated about Canyon Road galleries. I think it's really true that if you have a job, you have an income, and art is something really worth investing in because it's enriching, and it actually can be life-shifting, is my belief as well. Anyone who has a job can buy art, and it's just a good thing to come in and look, actually, even
Absolutely.
If you're not buying.
Absolutely.
You know?
And although this is not about me today, I know that You know, I've been educated just in the last 2 or 3 months being in Santa Fe. Yeah. Today what I'd like to do is kind of explore some of how you got to where you are today. Mm-hmm. And maybe even go back to childhood and your parents. Were they enthusiastic about the arts? Were they artistic per se? Or?
You know, the answer to that is no, actually. I think mm-hmm. I'm perhaps the exception to the rule in terms of my immediate family. My father is much more of an empirically based thinker. Mm-hmm. Although his mother, my grandmother, she did paint. And I think she had that yearning within herself, actually, to express herself in a more artistic, creative way that offered her the freedom that I think comes to you when you mm-hmm. are living that kind of life. So no, I'm basically the exception to the rule, except for my grandmother.
Okay, so in your family, there was you and your mother, and you grew up with your mother and father and mm-hmm. siblings?
Younger sister, my sister mm-hmm. Kimberly is 2.5 mm-hmm. years younger than
okay.
I. And, you know, I really, in a way, grew up with my parents because we're only 18 years apart in age. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I particularly really grew up with my mother.
Okay.
And my father became professionally very successful. His work took us all over the world, mm-hmm. actually, South America, North Africa, Switzerland. I also lived in Spain for a year, which was part of my undergraduate mm-hmm. studies. I was originally actually a modern linguist, not a painter or a writer. But again, it's all in the family of things, you mm-hmm. know, language, and I'm very grateful that I have that background also.
As a painter now, were you doing some of that as a young girl or a woman?
It started in high school,
okay.
and I did want to go on to art school mm-hmm. In England, but it didn't happen. My parents didn't encourage it. I think at the time they were concerned that possibly in England you couldn't get a bachelor's degree okay. in art. It was maybe they thought more like going to a trade school, but you know, who knows? I think sometimes when you have a formal education, perhaps in art, as a practicing professional artist years later, mm-hmm. sometimes you have to learn to relearn mm-hmm. the rules, you know, and drop the things that you've learned,
right,
and do it in your own individual way. So in some respects, I'm rather grateful in a sense that I
yeah.
don't have an MFA.
Yeah.
Although I, you know, I've taken a lot of classes
sure.
in painting.
Yeah, and
painting.
I've noticed that mm-hmm. you consider yourself somewhat of an art historian as well.
I mean, right.
You can pretty much identify different periods in art history and.
Well, I love art history, mm-hmm. I love reading,
mm-hmm.
and I did study at Sotheby Park Brunei in London too, which was really all about experiential learning and observation. It was several hours on a Monday in the classroom where they would outline what we were doing for the rest of the week, but then the rest of the week really was going to museums and galleries and historic homes
mm.
and looking directly at art and experiencing
it. How old were you then?
I would have been in my mid-20s.
Okay.
Mid-20s. And really, I say that was the best 3 months of my educational life.
Mm.
Interesting. I mean, it was what I loved to do. It was
right.
where my passion was.
Right.
I compare that to 4 years of a bachelor's art degree in languages. I learned as much in 3 months.
Right, absolutely. And the people that you were with at Sotheby's, were they also artists, per se?
It was a collage of people, actually.
Internationally,
people from all over the world. We had a French countess, actually,
nice.
In the class. And there
don't
was,
we all have
well, there was a
Well,
there's a funny story about that. She had the most fabulous clothes always, and she came into class, and you know, my father was an academic
mm-hmm.
and so she came in, and I was a little mesmerized always by her. And so one day I finally said, "Where do you shop, Countess?" And She said New York, London, and Paris.
Nice.
So that was Sotheby's for you.
Well, you were in London. So.
Yeah, New York, London, and Paris. So.
There you go. There you go. Did you begin painting at that point in your life, in your 20s?
I was painting in high school, so okay. Before my 20s. In my teens, I was painting.
Do you have a particular teacher or a particular instructor that was?
A wonderful teacher whose name I should remember. Miss Osmond Smith.
Okay.
And so, yeah, that was my favorite class always in high school. And you're a teacher, John, so yeah. you know how one teacher can change your life and change your perspective.
Well, how did she change yours? I mean, what was it about how she interacted with you that made a difference?
Well, I do remember her, and I remember how much I loved her classes. But mm-hmm. I would say that it was really the Sotheby's course mm-hmm. that... I knew I had found something that I truly loved mm-hmm. when I was studying there. But then I would say that one of the shift moments in my life actually was when I saw the work of Jackson Pollock at the Pompidou Center in Paris, and probably in my late 20s maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I will never forget the first time I saw those paintings live in the flesh, mm-hmm. the scale of them. Completely different from looking at a painting in a book.
I was going to ask you about what struck you.
Completely different from looking at a painting in a book. It didn't strike me in my head. It didn't mm-hmm. strike me intellectually. It struck me viscerally. And I was literally, my breath was taken away by it. I have never forgotten that. And I still believe now that that's the job of art. To carry you away, to take your breath away,
right.
to change something in your biology, mm-hmm. more in a sense than in your mind.
Mm.
So that's what seeing Jackson Pollock's paintings did for me way back then.
Right.
If we can call that a teacher, Jackson Pollock was my teacher.
I think something profound like that has an impact on your life. Now you've done some... large
abstract work.
Abstract,
yes, I have.
Would you call that expressionist or impressionist?
I call it abstract expressionist painting.
Okay.
Just for want of a term, I think mm-hmm. sometimes we feel like we need a niche to slot things into, to help us understand them. Just as knowing something about the art history of the work, the influences on the work, helps us intellectually to appreciate the work. But I'm such a huge advocate for simply experiencing the work mm-hmm. and allowing oneself enough time and space for the magic to happen.
Well, it's interesting because your works go from... you call them your nudes or your...
female figurative paintings,
yeah, your
yes.
female figurative paintings, which are pretty realistic, I would say. And then this
right.
passion for the abstract as well. It's interesting to me. I don't know what it means. But.
Well, you know, I would say that people looking at my work, I hope, would know that it's all my work, mm-hmm. even though perhaps there are... identifiable different styles,
mm-hmm.
but hopefully the me that's in the work is my signature. And often the abstract paintings were only signed on the back of the canvas, and I would say that the painting is my signature.
Right, right. And emotionally people can interact with that as they can with any of your work. Do the abstract, can I ask you a question?
This
sure, is
naive.
Absolutely. I'm not an art historian by any means, but I was wondering today if maybe an abstract work is actually allows more of an interaction because the imagination, because you don't really have identifiable objects. Mm.
Well, perhaps, yes, as the viewer, perhaps it opens the viewer up to more freedom and less sense of feeling inhibited
Or constrained by...
than one would by realism, which might give people a sense of that they needed to know something about it. What's mm-hmm. this thing mm-hmm. about? But, I've always said that more than a painting, more than being about something, having a narrative, a work of art actually is something. So whether it's an abstract or a figure or a landscape, it's what that work of art as an entity in itself does to a person looking at it. And that, you know, you as an educator, I think that that actually gives an enormous amount of freedom to someone looking at art, because it frees them from the requirement of knowing the history, knowing who painted it, even knowing the price. In an art gallery often can influence people's judgment about the value of the art. But the value really should come from simply experiencing it, as I had the opportunity to experience art when I studied at Sotheby's.
So you saw the Pollock after Sotheby's, right?
Is that I believe after? So, yes.
Yeah, a little bit after it. What other things struck you during that Sotheby's period? What in particular did you find moved you?
I would say that one thing was across genres, whether it's architecture, whether it's a beautiful piece of silver, whether it's a painting, whether it's a textile. You know, as Joseph Campbell talked about mythology being cross-cultural, and that you would find very similar stories even in cultures that had never interacted.
Right.
You see that across genres in art from the same period. There are connecting threads through architecture, through painting. And that is such an enlightened way of being able to learn, because you can make sense of the whole rather than learning about sculpture in isolation, painting, and discreetly. So the way they were teaching at Sotheby's worked for me in terms of how I was a learner.
Yeah, absolutely. So there you are in London. Now, we didn't talk much about your life, your family moving around a little bit. Care to touch upon any of that as something that informs you even today? As a youngster moving around the world, that's a unique opportunity. So
yes, and I probably didn't realize how unique it was in the moment. And I have my parents to thank for the fact that I did have the opportunity to be exposed to different countries, different cultures.
You're still with your posse in each one of these.
You're
still with your group of friends.
I was accompanying my parents their journey, so
there was
good fortune in that. But I think all of it was a kind of a gathering of myself from my very early years with my parents. And that's where, of course, my interest in languages came from as well. To your question, I think that exposure as a child started piecing together the me that I am today, a gathering of all of those pieces and forming the collage.
Do you remember being in art classes in some of these international places as a student?
I do remember being in art class in Geneva in Switzerland. I was at the international school there,
right,
the English side of the international school, and they had fabulous facilities there. So I actually did a lot of print work when I was at school there. Unfortunately, I wasn't there long enough.
Is that like a litho thing?
Lithographic work, yes. Yes.
I love those litho stones, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you work on drawing there too? Would you call yourself a drawer as a child, as a young woman?
No.
Were you doodling in notebooks?
We had drawing classes at school, but you know, Leonardo da Vinci could draw. Rembrandt could draw. And I've never wanted to compete with those people or take the time to practice the art of drawing for years and years and years. I'm more of a spontaneous, I think, intuitive painter. Perhaps that partly comes from my background of just pulling all these disparate things together into the I that I was and the I that I am.
We might edit this out, but has anybody ever called you a third culture kid?
A third
culture kid.
I never heard that term.
You don't really belong to the American culture. You don't really belong to the culture where you're temporarily located.
Right.
You're actually kind of a composite.
Well, border crosser is the term I think that I used when you walked into the gallery, and I heard that term fairly recently in the last year, and it was told to me by a woman who asked me where I was from. When I started explaining to her, she said, "Oh, you're a border crosser," and her background is in psychiatric work. So that term, I believe, is an actual professional, almost clinical term, a border crosser. So when she said that to me, I said, "Well, that's fabulous, because I finally know what I am, and there's an actual term to describe me," and it gave me actually a sense of comfort.
Right.
Because I have always had a longing to find home, I would say.
Yeah.
And the fact that you can be a person who lives with that longing, I'm okay with that now.
Right, yeah.
That makes for interesting people.
Restlessness, moving on, being somewhat...
Well, I think that term restlessness that you used is key, because that encompasses curiosity, which has a positive connotation to it, and so perhaps that is the person that I didn't know I always was.
Yeah.
And then suddenly there's a term for it, and I think as an artist, and perhaps I became an artist because of those qualities, you know, putting yourself under the umbrella of calling yourself an artist, suddenly it makes sense of that very varied background that I had.
Yeah, in part, yeah, I think so, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Do you think that post-childhood, post-Sotheby's, did you imagine yourself, probably not if you're restless, but did you imagine yourself where you are today, in your 30s, per se, that you would end up...
Well, I never imagined I would end up living in the United States, because I grew up primarily in England, in Europe. Although I am an American citizen, so I had come back over many years to visit family, there's a sort of a romantic quality, I would say, about my nature. So whether I imagine myself specifically in the place that I am, there's that quality of longing, pushing the boundaries, a bit of an explorer. Because I had such a varied childhood, met a lot of different kinds of people, lived in underdeveloped countries, and that does open your mind up, if your mind is open to being open.
It's hard not to have it open, I would think, for most children. I mean, some respond differently. I mean, you and I can both talk about children that probably didn't do too well in moving overseas, but I think it does open minds. For sure.
Well, for me, it was hard in terms of having a very chopped up educational background.
Yeah.
And when we finally did land in England, because the education system, certainly at the time there, was very rigid, I had a hard time knowing that I could compete. Yeah. But the other side of that coin is I have all those other positives that today I really...
Yeah.
Do see them as very strong positives.
Yeah.
So maybe if I had wanted to be an engineer or a doctor or something, that background wouldn't make so much sense.
Was that talked about in your family? We really appreciate her interest in art, but we know that she's got this ability to work with numbers.
It was not talked about. In fact, I would say the opposite of talked about. And my analysis of that is because my father was an intellectual. Education, in my way of thinking, was the value of it was to broaden the mind, to educate the mind, and not necessarily have a final destination of a career that financially supported your life.
Right.
And I felt that not only from the influence of my father in particular, but also the British education system per se, is very elite, and it is very much about learning and about the mind.
Learning how to learn.
And thank goodness
right.
that I have that, but But it didn't point me in the direction I felt of a career.
And the only reason I ask that is because out of the working class, suburban post-World War II, baby boomer milieu that I grew up in, we all had directions that we had to go in.
Yes. Well, in some way, I regret that I didn't have that. But I found the life of an artist, living life in art, and it gives you a lot of freedom.
Well, let's get you into your 30s. You're past Sotheby's now. Where are you in your 30s? Are you back in the United States? Are you in the United States? Are you still?
Well, in my 30s, I took the path.
If you don't mind me referring to age,
Not at all. Okay. No, I'm 63 now.
All right, there it is, people.
But you know, Deepak Chopra, I believe, when he was asked his age, I believe it was, he said, you know, I don't remember my age, but I must be very old because I have grandchildren. Again, that's something where we tend to slot people, right?
Right.
Make assumptions based on preconceptions.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get a linear idea of your life, though. In your 30s, where did you find yourself in your 30s, per se, as if you were in one place?
Well, again, it was interesting, my parents being so young when they had their children. And then my father having a very successful academic career.
What was he into?
Development economics, which is what took us to these different countries. My mother does not have a college degree, so she's a very intelligent, self-taught, autodidact. But she supported my father. In a way, she enabled my father to, I believe, to achieve what he did achieve. So I had the image of my father as a very successful intellectual and academic, and then the image of my mother as a mother and a homemaker and a woman who enabled her husband to become as successful as he became. So in my 30s, I was married, had a child when I was 35. So I feel like I was very much mirroring my mother at that time.
Okay. Where were you living?
Well, I've lived in 10 or 12 different cities.
In your 30s?
In the United States. I more or less left England when I was 23, 24.
Okay.
And came back to the United States.
All right. And so you were living where when you had your baby?
My daughter Chelsea was born in Bellevue, Washington, in the Pacific Northwest.
Okay.
And I fell in love with the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yes.
I love it.
Seattle, and then more recently lived in Portland, Oregon. Yes.
Right.
Yeah, and it's still, that whole area is still very dear to my heart. I would say the Pacific Northwest and the coast of Oregon, and then here, the desert Southwest.
During those times when you're really busy as a mother and married and so on, were you creating art at that point?
Or
were you?
I was taking classes, painting classes all along.
And were you what kind of classes were those? I mean, I don't know.
Well,
art classes per se. I don't know.
Painting classes, and actually, it was the result of a class I took at Marylhurst University on the outskirts of Portland, which is now, I believe, closed down. But I was taking a class there in abstract painting, basically, and my instructor invited me to have the first show at an art gallery that she had opened. So that was really the beginning. And I would say that's kind of a pivotal point for me, was the fact that she offered me the opportunity for a one-woman show in her new gallery in downtown Portland, Oregon.
So you're a mother.
Yeah.
And you're married.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're showing your art.
Exactly. So the wheels started to turn.
Wow. That's impressive.
Yeah.
That's impressive. What do you eat for breakfast? No, we won't get into your daily diet, but tell me more showing. Yes.
I do say that, and I know, John, that you're very interested in getting more and more into the creative life. In my personal experience, and I think if you read about how artists became artists, it's that one door that very quietly opens. Sure. And this is what happened to me when I had the show in Portland. Mm-hmm. That one little door quietly opened. And it had just been a passion for me up mm-hmm. until then. And suddenly I'm offered a show where my paintings are on the wall and there's price stickers on mm-hmm. my paintings.
Yeah.
So that one little door opens, and if you walk through that door, the unknown actually is on the other side mm-hmm. of that, and it certainly right. was for me. And so there's the drive, the curiosity,
sure.
the desire
right.
that I very much had.
Tell me some memories
so
about
exciting.
That show. Tell me some memories that you have about that specific showing.
Well, it was a beautiful little gallery. It was
okay.
a small gallery, maybe four times the size of the space that we're in.
Okay.
And it was all my paintings on the wall.
Hmm.
And I sold a number of pieces.
Wow.
So, you know, there's validation.
Right.
Right there.
Right.
And I hear so often in the art gallery, Marigold Arts, where I work,
right.
people come in and they say they don't have a creative bone in their,
right.
in their body.
Right.
But when you get that little validation, when you get that feedback and that reward, and you know that as a teacher,
right.
when you tell a child that
right.
what they're doing has value,
right.
who and knows where the limit of that
right.
is. So that was what I was receiving at that
That's
moment
awesome.
From this wonderful teacher.
Yeah. Who was that?
Karen Drake, actually,
okay.
was her name. I
okay.
have no idea what she's doing
yeah,
now.
Yeah, let's get Karen in here.
Yes.
That's awesome.
So she started me on my way, actually, to being a professional painter.
And so the paintings, how would you describe those paintings at that point in your life? What were they?
They were abstract works, mm-hmm. multimedia. I was doing a lot of texturizing
mm-hmm.
On the surface of the paper. I was then working on paper, but using crazy things like crumpled up wax paper, cling film. There was an artist named Maxine Masterfield,
mm-hmm.
and she had at that time she had produced a couple of books
mm-hmm.
on process and method and how to
mm-hmm.
how to do a lot of these things. So
mm-hmm.
I read her book and used a lot of her tips
mm-hmm.
and it was very experimental
mm-hmm.
and produced these kind of flowing textured multimedia paintings on paper. One of the things that I did was I learned to use a polymer, which I put over the top of these paintings.
Okay.
So it was like a very thick varnish.
Okay.
So it made
right.
it made the paintings feel luminous and feel deep,
mm-hmm.
and it gave them
mm-hmm.
another dimension that,
mm-hmm.
that the works didn't have without it.
Mm-hmm.
So again, that kind of, I think, springboarded
right.
me forward.
Right. Right.
And to sell a painting for $500 is pretty nice, you know.
That's
you're
great.
I mean, when you think
yeah.
about it, how
yeah.
many people ever sell a painting in their
right.
lifetimes
right.
for $500
right.
or
right.
$5,000,
yeah.
which I was
no.
doing a few years later?
No. And yeah, so, but the risk-taking was yours. I mean,
yes.
You took the risk. You put yourself out there. You were the brave woman in the situation who said, I
well,
can do this.
That's that moment when you're at that crossroads
mm-hmm.
and you have to choose. Am I going left or am I going right?
Mm-hmm. But nobody told you that these things were going to be sold off the wall. Maybe they did, but nobody said.
No, it's
and you just went for it.
Yeah. Having the work on the wall, even without the sales, would have been incredible.
Exactly.
At that time.
It's
an amazing feeling.
For sure.
When
for sure.
your work is published in a book, or your
mm-hmm.
work is put on the wall in
mm-hmm.
an art gallery,
mm-hmm.
And then let alone when someone takes it home with them and wants it as part of their life and
yeah.
part of their family.
I don't want to re-loop this all back
Go
to
ahead.
Your family all the time, but how'd the fam deal with all of that?
Well, my mother came, yeah. My sister came from England, and were actually at my opening. And my mother has always been one of the biggest supporters of my work. Mm-hmm. And her support is support of me, mm-hmm. as much as it is of the work itself.
Right. She's a great mom.
I'm very grateful to my mother for believing in me.
Absolutely.
Even through some dark passages, let's put it that way.
Okay. Yeah. So when you're doing this, you're selling some paintings, you're in, what, your 30s still, or early, late 30s?
I would actually 20s. After my daughter was born.
Right.
So she was 8, mm-hmm. so I would have been early 40s by then, yes.
Okay. So you had the show. Let's just stay with your art for a second here. So you had the show. You got very excited about the show. It opened up all kinds of worlds for you. What happened? What did you do with all that energy?
I then decided that I needed to scale my work up, paint larger.
Hmm.
And that was a very important decision because that enabled me then to get my work into a Portland, Oregon gallery.
Describe scaling. I understand what you're talking about, but maybe some people don't. So what?
From a standard piece of watercolor paper, whatever that is, two by three maybe.
Right.
To then working on canvas, from paper to canvas, and I went to 6 feet by 8 feet size paintings. So I actually then I built a little studio at the house where I was living, so I could paint larger.
Mm-hmm.
So I painted both on what I call wall easels, where the unstretched canvas was actually stapled to the wall,
and
I painted vertically.
Right.
And I also had some tables built for myself, just plywood and 2x4 tables,
right.
So I could also work horizontally, so I could actually move around the table and doing these abstract paintings.
When you did those back then, did you work on several pieces at once?
Yes, several pieces at once, which was such a gift to go from making small paintings on one table, one at a time, to suddenly, and part of being able to be a successful artist is having the facilities. As a painter, it's having the space to paint,
well,
having, as you
size,
say,
yeah.
the opportunity to work on more pieces than at once, because when you start selling your work and having that vision of your work beginning to support you financially, there is an element of, quote, production that comes into it. You know, how fast can I paint? How many can I paint at one time? So by giving myself that studio, that was another little door again, in a way that I opened for myself.
Right.
And you go through another door and,
you
know, where the hell is it going to take you?
That's amazing. That's amazing to me. I mean, it's amazing to me that you could scale up and you realize that, whoa, okay, this can, with my name on it, this can command this amount of money, and this will be, you know.
Well, you know, at that time I was married, so I wasn't having to financially support myself.
Right.
But I was taking those little opportunities that I, in a sense, I created for myself, I suppose.
Okay.
And going down that path.
Yeah, yeah. And did you have shows of those larger works that
Well, I eventually,
how did you move those?
Eventually, my paintings were accepted into a major art gallery in Portland, Oregon, the Lawrence Gallery, which they had, I think, 3 different locations at that time, and they were spoken of as the largest gallery in Oregon.
Now, were those openings as well? I mean, did you show up when these things were displayed? Or?
Oh, yes, as the painter.
Right.
Because people always, I find, they love making the connection of the work with the artist, because it's just enriching for people.
Absolutely.
It takes them on a journey then. It's not.
Well, that's what I'm doing right now.
That's what you're doing. Yeah, we're on a journey together, John, absolutely.
I'm just along for the ride. When you did that, when you moved into that part of your artistic life, did you find that people were coming up with questions about how they could do what you're doing, or could you help them? Were they asking for your assistance in creating pieces, or
not so much?
Okay.
I would say I tend to be asked more now, mm-hmm. Sitting in the art gallery on mm-hmm. Canyon Road,
right.
By artists in particular, how they get representation.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much how they paint. I'm one of those artists that I don't believe you can ever copy another artist's
right.
work, so I'm pretty open to
right.
sharing. Not all artists are that way,
right.
I believe.
Right.
Because your art, if it's going to speak to people, it really has to come from your bones and
mm-hmm.
your soul and
mm-hmm.
your blood.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't worry about whether people are going to copy me. And I don't want to look like anybody else's work anyway.
If you had these large pieces, how many pieces did you have in your 40s? Did you have quite a few large pieces? Were you actually moving these? Or
well, in my 40s, when I had the studio,
mm-hmm.
and then, gosh, it was a year, maybe a couple years after I was shown at the Lawrence Gallery.
Right.
I opened my own gallery in Portland, and I had an adjoining studio that was 2,500 square feet.
This is the gallery that mm-hmm. you had for 10 years or
yes,
so?
Yes, right. Exactly. The Janice
right.
Griffin Gallery in the Pearl in
right.
the Pearl District in Portland, Oregon.
With your partner.
Right, Thomas Paul Augustine.
Right, mm-hmm. right. How long between that kind of move towards the canvas, the larger pieces, and your own gallery? What are we talking? 5 years, 10 years?
I think it was 1 or 2 years.
Oh,
not that long, actually. Yes.
Okay.
So that decision to paint larger paintings,
mm-hmm.
and then the Lawrence Gallery, eventually they actually put 3 of my 6 feet by 8 feet paintings in the front window of the gallery, and that's when the work started to sell.
That is such
so
a physical
had visibility.
We haven't even talked about it, but that's such a physical feat just to create something that
it
large,
is.
Isn't
it?
It's so physical,
yeah.
the work.
It's painting at that scale is exactly what you say, John. It's a physical process,
yeah.
and I responded to that.
Hmm.
I like the physicality of
right.
it. I like using my whole body
right.
in almost a balletic kind
right.
of way.
I know you're into movement.
Right.
right. right.
It's very different from painting a small window size painting where you're using your fingers, your wrist, your hand, your arm.
Right.
Painting those large scale works, your whole body's in it. You're always living in the piece and
that's
living
so awesome.
In the canvas and eating the paint almost.
Did you have situations? Now again, I come at this not as an artist, so I don't know. But did you have pieces that were large, you had invested some time in, and then went, well, that's crap, I'm not going to put that in. Did you ever have to do that?
You know, I always laugh because I don't like to practice. I don't like to do practice pieces.
Okay.
I just start the painting,
uh-huh.
and it goes where it's going to go.
And I can attest that you know what you're doing.
And
so
I've had very few that have ended up in the dustbin. That's
that
just my approach.
Or you don't get irritated at the piece or something pops up and you go... Mm.
When I first began to work large scale,
mm.
It was a battle between me and the canvas
mm.
and the paint. I mean,
yeah.
it was war.
Yeah.
And it really felt like I had an opponent
mm-hmm.
there.
Interesting.
And that paint on the paintbrush was almost like a sword.
Mm.
And we were literally battling each other.
Interesting.
And still to this day, I'm not battling when I'm painting, but the painting feels like a being
mm-hmm.
of its own
ah.
that I'm interacting with.
Yes, yes, yes.
But I won the war, hopefully.
Yeah. I hope so. Now, these pieces, when you let's talk a little bit about moving into your
mm-hmm.
own place
mm-hmm.
in Portland, because
mm-hmm.
that was a significant part of your life.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Tell me, let's just start at the beginning and tell me a little bit about that whole experience, if you can. We only have 2 minutes.
No, only
we
2 minutes.
No,
we have to do significant editing.
We have some time.
Well, it was.
No, but tell me about moving from. Yeah.
Mm, It was extraordinary. And at that time, the leases in the Pearl District were still somewhat affordable. Now the whole neighborhood has become super gentrified.
Yeah.
And actually the space where I had the studio and the gallery is now a high-rise condo building. But to have that amount of square footage, 2,500 square foot gallery to display my work, it really, again, it informs the artist, it informs the maker of what's possible. And to see my work like that, it was almost, there was almost a disassociation. It almost felt like that cannot be my work. But it was my work.
Seems like unbelievable.
And it very much told me that most of us, most of the time, we limit ourselves and we don't comprehend the potential that we actually contain within ourselves. So when I made the decision to lease that space, that really informed me of what I was doing with myself artistically, and that it had validity.
It seems that there was pillars of support for you there, financial pillars, because you were able to lease, you were able to sign a lease and get that space and do the work.
Well, I really began selling my work.
Okay.
And I went from a $500 painting from my first show to being in the $5,000 category and sold my paintings internationally. And I mean, not that I made a lot of money, because I did have the lease and there's cost involved just in production. And I had a foreman who supported the gallery as well and did a lot of the physical labor who had to be paid. And I invested a lot of my own personal funds in being able to do that. But that's what our personal funds should be for. They should be for supporting our lives and discovering ourselves, actually. And that's the choice that I made at that time to do.
How many people, you know, I don't know the answer to this. I don't think anybody knows the answer. But how many people are artistic and they never take those steps that you do?
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
That was an incredible good fortune,
well,
to an extent.
And also, when we reach the end of our lives, what is it that, looking back, that we want to know about ourselves?
Right.
And no matter where I go with the rest of my life, I believe that I've already experienced that sensation of what all of us want to know at the end of our lives, and that feeling of actually bliss, and it's actually a feeling of love.
Right.
To be able to make something that fills your soul in the process of making it, and that then connects with someone else's soul, is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, that is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a unique feeling.
So I gave myself that gift in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Was it the kind of thing where you were painting on a just get down to the nuts and bolts of your life in Portland? Were you painting every week? Were you exclusively painting? Were you?
I was painting 24/7,
really?
As well as being a mother to my wonderful child, Chelsea.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So she's you know, the other
right.
the creative
how's Chelsea
gift
doing?
In my life.
Yeah, absolutely.
My child and then my paintings.
Would Chelsea hang out in the studio with you?
Oh, she loved it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, she loved it. She was really proud of me. She
uh-huh.
had a band when she was in high school, so she also loved the fact that her band was occasionally permitted to perform in the art gallery, and her friends were invited. And that was my first opportunity to be a public speaker in front of a microphone, actually, was to introduce Chelsea's band. And I found sound of my voice was okay, you know. It was a little bit of a feeling of kind of being powerful behind that microphone.
Thank you for coming tonight.
That was about it. And then the rock stars let loose.
If you don't happen to have the capital to purchase, maybe your parents do. Yes. Plenty of things to look at.
It's all about exposure, and there's many different ways to get exposure, for sure.
Exactly,
yes.
Exactly. Now, these paintings were sold. We could go on and on, nuts and bolts of selling paintings and delivering them and so on. Right. Did people walk into the gallery and just start speaking with you or Thomas, or how does that work? Or did people call you up and go, we have this space that we're looking for something exactly what you've done?
Well, I did very minimal but very targeted advertising. Mm. And I still have to this day a great friend in Portland, Oregon, who was in the advertising arena. He actually published the city walking maps for Portland. So
I picked one of those up.
So he advised me, and he also helped me to get on the inside front cover of the hotel book that is distributed in all of the hotels. Mm-hmm. And I think every city has them, including Santa Fe here. So that was a really good decision to put my ad there, because I found that when people would call the gallery or come in, often it was because they had seen this ad. So they already knew what they were coming to look at. So, and it's very different from my experience on Canyon Road, where it's a tourist situation, where in the peak months here, you get hundreds of people coming in.
Foot traffic, right.
But you don't necessarily know if that one individual is going to be interested in the art that's being sold in that particular gallery. So in my situation in Portland, it was really different.
Right.
So I didn't have to deal with hundreds of people.
Right.
I already knew if the person was in there, they were probably interested in what I was doing.
Ah, interesting. That's a different.
So a lot of women bought my work, a lot of female couples, a lot of male couples. So I had an interesting profile on the people who purchased my work.
Okay. You stay in touch with some of those?
Some of my clients have become good friends, yes.
Right.
Yeah, which is very nice.
That's terrific.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would imagine. The idea of running a gallery, painting full-time, having this gallery space to show, it sounds like an idyllic place. What happened? 2011, you got restless? Is it 2012? I can't recall the date.
I don't know what year it was. I had the gallery for 10 years.
Right.
And by then, my daughter was in college. Mm. There were rent issues coming into play in the Pearl District.
It sounds like they were in development.
Yeah. Oh, very much in development. Mm-hmm. I think Portland still now is the number one destination for people moving to new cities in the country. So I left right before that boom happened. So it was actually a good move. Perhaps it was intuitive. I had never come to New Mexico, actually. But I knew all about Santa Fe as being such a strong center for the arts, partly because my daughter was on her way, spreading her wings like a work of art, going out into the world, needing to do her thing. That gave me the opportunity to look at possibilities for myself. And I say that I could drive around downtown Santa Fe without a map when I came here, never having visited before, because I had read so much I was fascinated by the women in particular who had come here in the early 20th century, and the layers of different peoples and cultures and the power of the land here, which we don't have time to talk about Duende, but you know the term.
Right.
There's something in the power and the rawness and the energy that's contained in Mother Earth in this area that is definitely a catalyst for creativity. And it's hard to explain or talk about in scientific terms, But I felt that when I came here.
Right.
And as I was saying, I could drive around downtown because I had read so much already
before
I came, and I knew how to get around.
Right.
But it was a really good move, as mm-hmm. much as I love the Pacific Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
There's something really magical about.
And we've talked about that.
You and I have talked quite a bit about it. And you feel the same. I think, John, I do. Yeah.
Sure. And the space that we're in, or the place that we're in, it's hard not to imagine, hard not to be thinking imaginative, I believe.
Yes, and so there's a reason, not that I know a lot yet about the indigenous cultures here, but there's surely a reason why people started migrating and gathering and settling
mm-hmm.
In this area, and mm-hmm. you hear people talk about it as being a chosen place, like mm-hmm. it's on the crossroads of energy fields, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I don't know about all of that, but
mm-hmm. a little woo-woo. Yeah,
but yeah, women have been coming here, and people
right.
are drawn to this area.
Right, and that's another aspect of. We're gonna have to maybe pick another time to talk mm. about some of that, but
right.
that whole aspect of your art and mm. the power of women
right.
is something that we haven't gotten into. Jada, mm-hmm. we've been here about an hour, and I think it's been a terrific conversation.
I think we've gotten
you to Santa Fe, and hopefully we can speak again, and maybe we can add to this.
There's so much more to tell and to explore, and yes, I really shifted from abstract paintings into more female figurative work.
Yeah.
So that's another conversation.
Well, let's have that. Thanks again for coming in.
Thank you so much, John.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Yes, there's more to Jada's story that we may have to cover in a later podcast. But I want to thank her for her time, her candidness, and her insights into what it feels like to be an artist, an entrepreneur, and truly a woman of spiritual substance. Well, until next time, this is John Lund of Thinking It Through, thanking you for your time and your attention. Have a fine day.